The first papers are Tai et al., ctDNA-guided adjuvant chemotherapy de-escalation in stage 3 colon cancer, primary analysis of the ctDNA-negative cohort from the randomized AGITG Dynamic 3 trial, ESMO 2025, abstract LBA9. Bikai Saab, discussion of LBA9, ESMO 2025, and Tai et al., circulating tumor DNA-guided adjuvant therapy in locally advanced colon cancer, the randomized phase 2-3 Dynamic 3 trial, Nature Medicine 2025. So let's talk about the Dynamic 3 trial presented at the recent ESMO meeting, got a lot of attention. Dr. Saab did a discussion of the paper. We see the publication now in Nature Medicine. It just came out. So can you talk a little bit about this study and what they saw?
Right. So this is the Australian or the AGITG study that was looking at the stage 3 population. It's kind of a phase 2 power. The randomization, it's a very practical study to standard management where ctDNA results weren't utilized, or in a stage 3 patient, if you're negative, to de-escalate what you are planning to do. And if positive, think about how can you escalate treatment. Now, in Australia, there is a bit of monotherapy, 5-FU, that was utilized here as part of standard management. But most patients were getting the adjuvant with FOLFOX. But we did see less chemotherapy utilized. So that, you know, again, ctDNA guided saw an overall lower rate of adjuvant therapy there. This, importantly, was a single time point. So post-op, single draw with a, you know, we'd argue maybe a bit of an older but still tumor-informed ctDNA assay and use that to make that treatment decision. What was seen here were curves that were close, but there was a little bit of a separation there, and they had a non-inferiority margin that they were not able to demonstrate non-inferiority in this with it. So what we saw was that if you're ctDNA negative, you had a very low risk, and that treatment de-escalation was feasible with high adherence, with a lot less oxaliplatin utilization, better outcomes there, but not able to confirm with the barriers of the current assay, the standard of care was non-inferior, or that the ctDNA defined was non-inferior to standard of care.
Anything you want to say about Dr. Saab's commentary after this was presented?
No, I think it, you know, highlighted the realities of that we have to make decisions on the basis of our of the data we have in hand, and that while we want prospective data to help guide us, we have to really consider clinical significance beyond the statistical margin, especially for these, you know, smaller studies like the Dynamic 3. So, you know, the point about, you know, you've got to have a good test. And the idea is not perhaps a single time point test, but serial testing is the other kind of component, as mentioned, that is really critical.
So you mentioned, I guess this is another bespoke assay, but it was not Signatera. Any thoughts about, is there a difference in quality between these? Could that be explain, you know, I guess the lack of, the fact there was a slight difference there?
Absolutely. I think, you know, there's... you know, it still, we think tumor-informed are the kind of best type of test. We always, you know, have to execute the study with the best assay that's available at the time the study launches. You know, if we were kicking off a study now, would it be that assay? No, but we do have better assays that are available now that allow us to better define that population maybe that we don't want to de-escalate.
So, you know, a lot of this discussion kind of reminds me of what happened in breast cancer when the Oncotype came out. It was 2004, and that became a critical factor in decision-making in oncology and breast cancer. And one of the things that sort of came along with that, and I think a lot about here in this whole discussion, is the patient perspective on some of these numbers, so to speak. Because there are people out there who can understand and are interested in the numbers. You might have a medical oncologist as a patient for that matter. And it reminded me, too, that you know, we've had a lot of posters over the years, our group, usually based on surveys we've done. But we only had one oral that I ever had to present. It was actually at the ASCO GI meeting, I don't know, at least 10, maybe 15 years ago. And what we did, we tried to like reproduce what was done in breast cancer. We went to people who'd gotten adjuvant therapy for colon cancer. And we said, how much benefit would you have wanted to see for getting adjuvant chemotherapy? And we gave them, you know, these charts that showed, you know, 10 out of 100, 3 out of 100, whatever. And in fact, we saw that there was a significant cohort, about a third of these people, who would go through it again for like a 1% difference in relapse-free survival, which kind of reminds everybody of the breast numbers. Incidentally, no difference between men and women, no difference. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing was we saw a number of people, not as many, maybe 10, 15%, who wouldn't take therapy again for like a 10% absolute improvement in survival. So it really kind of showed the heterogeneity of how people look at these numbers. Any thoughts about how you see people processing? You know, here you have a study that, you know, I don't know whether you consider it negative or not. Maybe it wasn't as positive as we hoped, but it looks like it provided a lot of interesting information.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it really does make that discussion, you know, very different. For, you know, years, I would prepare mentally when I went into a room to have a discussion about adjuvant therapy with stage two, right, versus stage three. And I would say, okay, like 30 minutes for the stage two, 5 minutes for the stage three, right? It's kind of clear cut. Now it's almost the inverse, right? The stage two, we know what we're doing, ctDNA, if you're positive, adjuvant, if not, not. And it's the stage threes now that we are having this much longer discussion as we get more of this information and I think start to have to integrate this into what the patient's wishes and desires are and what they hope to get out of adjuvant therapy. So great, great point.
It also kind of gets into the downside of adjuvant therapy, in addition to the, you know, economic and convenience and issues. To me, one big issue is neuropathy from oxaliplatin. And I'm curious, when you think back over the years, like how much of a problem do you see neuropathy in the adjuvant setting?
Yeah, it's still an issue, especially for those patients that we are kind of committing to 6 months of adjuvant therapy. For example, I think it's better now with our where we're using less 3 months of adjuvant therapy for our lower risk stage three patients. But there's still room to improve because we know that even some of what we think are classically high-risk patients really aren't. And so we may still be over-treating a majority of patients.
I would think that quite a few people might have baseline neuropathy already from type 2 diabetes. When you look at a patient like that who has, you know, not, you know, has some neuropathy to start with, or people without neuropathy, roughly speaking, if you think about giving them adjuvant therapy for 6 months, what's the chance you're going to have to hold or discontinue oxali?
Oh, 90%+ of the time. So typically we tell patients that somewhere around, you know, dose number 8 to 10 is usually where we have to, you know, stop the oxaliplatin. Acknowledging that there can be delayed neuropathy that can appear, you know, 6-8 weeks after our last dose.
The next paper is Nowak et al., Prognostic and Predictive Role of ctDNA in Stage 3 Colon Cancer Treated with Celecoxib, finding from CALGB Alliance SWOG 80702, GI Cancer Symposium 2025, Abstract LBA 14. This is one of my favorite studies. This is from the GI Symposium this year. I've always been fascinated by the lifestyle and the aspirin, celecoxib studies in colon cancer. And finally, we get a kind of cool study here with the CLGB and SWOG. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this was a study that was initially done before the era of ctDNA, it was part of the IDEA consortium. 3 months versus 6 months. But there's a second randomization that was there, and that was celecoxib or not. So this was, you know, celecoxib to continue daily for 3 years, started with the adjuvant therapy. So the report then said, okay, now we have this tool, ctDNA, let's go back and apply ctDNA retrospectively to this this data. The initial study, we should remind ourselves, was negative, that in all comers, celecoxib didn't really add much, maybe a little trend, a p-value of 0.1, but nothing there. But the impressive thing was that when they went back and added in ctDNA, and now, of course, the ctDNA negative patients did great. No benefit of anything beyond that. But obviously, ctDNA positive patients had a much worse outcome. But a substantially meaningful improvement in outcome, hazard ratio 0.55 for the use of celecoxib in the positive patients with a significant interaction. And that showed up as an overall survival benefit there as well. Survival of 0.58. Like, these are really meaningful differences in overall survival. Retrospective study, but still, this is celecoxib, you know, fairly benign, well-tolerated for 3 years. So this is really compelling because it's at least suggesting ctDNA can be predictive of benefit of adjuvant therapy. So not just prognostic, but actually tell us something that we could potentially do with that. So there's a lot of questions like, do we need to repeat this? Is this, or based on what we understand about the performance of ctDNA here, is this something that should be changing practices now? I'm more in the latter. I've changed my practice on the basis of this, but it is something that is not yet in the guidelines, but may find its way there in the near future.
And are you using celecoxib or aspirin?
So using celecoxib in this setting, there's a second addition to the guidelines about the use of aspirin in patients that have a PIK3CA mutation. So that's a about maybe a 1 in 5, 1 in 6 of our patients that have that. But for the remaining patients, it's really about using ctDNA to guide the use of celecoxib.
And do you think the fact that they saw the benefit here was really a events thing, that they were able to get more events and you can kind of see better what's going on? Or you think qualitatively the patients or the tumor is different?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one way to think about this is if we had a perfect crystal ball, which is not ctDNA, but if we had a perfect crystal ball and knew who had micrometastatic disease, and could separate them and those that did or didn't, then of course we would say logically, of course, the benefit is only going to be in those patients that have CT, that have minimal residual disease and microscopic disease, and not in those that were cured. So the closer that our assays get to the pure crystal ball, I think the closer it will be to really defining a population that is only the ones that should be treated.
Any comments on the mechanism involved? You were mentioning aspirin and the AKT pathway. What about celecoxib? And is it about the AKT pathway here?
So there is some data that suggests that it could be through that kind of COX-2 mechanism that may impact CREB and feed forward loop through the PI3 kinase pathway. The COX inhibitors also have some information on inflammation that signaling that may be relevant. Aspirin has an additional ability to inhibit COX-1 and actually can decrease some of the tumor platelet aggregates in circulation. So I think there may be some overlapping biology, but they're not identical to each other. They may be working through different mechanisms.
The next papers are Bando et al., a randomized double-blind phase 3 study comparing trifluridine tipiracil versus placebo in patients with molecular residual disease following curative resection of colorectal cancer, the ALTAIR study, GI Cancer Symposium 2025, abstract LBA 22, and Nakamura et al., clinical validation of a methylation-based tissue-free colorectal cancer test for the detection of molecular residual disease by ctDNA, ESMO GI 2025, abstract 93P. So next paper, this is again from the ASCO GI meeting this year, the ALTAIR study.
So again, kudos to the leadership of our Japanese colleagues as part of the GALAXY study, able to embed a prospective randomized study. And this is the first prospective randomized study to look at a novel therapy, or at least not approved in adjuvant setting. And what they did was they took patients that were positive during surveillance and randomized them to receive trifluridine tipiracil, TAS-102, or placebo, because there is no standard of care in these patients after they've received adjuvant therapy and are part of surveillance. The study showed some trends, but unfortunately no real improvements in durable outcome. What we saw was a little bit of a delay. As you can imagine, using TAS-102 may delay recurrences for a bit, but unfortunately the curves then come back together. There's no, we're not curing anybody by the addition of this. There was this trend, but unfortunately I would say kind of a negative study, but showing that we can do this study. And we now have other studies following in its footsteps. There's an ADC study that is launching that's the ABV-400, the study to look at a CMET ADC. But we're going to see more studies in this setting as well. So I think this was a good proof of principle and is setting the stage for what I think is going to be a bit of a rush to develop novel therapies in MRD.
Yeah, I guess, again, thinking about PSA and prostate cancer, one big difference here is they've got endocrine therapy that everybody responds dramatically to, and we kind of struggle with colorectal cancer. So maybe we have something more effective. The benefit will be more apparent in some of these studies.
Absolutely, and we hope that there's things that we can do there. Immunotherapy, for example, vaccines may be the perfect setting to deploy these in the MRD setting, where we know once the tumor is bulky and widely metastatic, they're less effective.
That's a great point. Are there trials right now that you're excited about using vaccines in colorectal cancer? Have you seen any benefits?
There are, yes. Really interesting ones involved in one that is using a personalized mRNA vaccine. So it's being run by BioNTech. That study's completed enrollment. Waiting for readout of that. That is ctDNA positive patients randomized to adjuvant with or without that personalized mRNA vaccine. That's one of many. There's also work being done with KRAS vaccines in this space as well. So a lot of interest for sure.
Another assay, a methylation-based tissue-free colorectal cancer test that was reported at ESMO GI. Sounds really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about what this is?
Yeah, so a lot of the tests that are being done, the tumor-informed tests, are looking at DNA, at mutations. But we also know that there can be epigenetic differences in the tumors that that can help signal that there's tumor in circulation and not blood. So this was a tumor-naive, so it's not tumor-informed or tissue-free assay. So it has some advantages of a little bit of faster turnaround time. And again, showing a very, very kind of impressive separation and these curves in this cohort. In the surveillance window, the questions remain about, is there a 20% false positive, meaning patients that that may be positive on this test and not have recurrent disease. So there's a little bit of a concern that there may be a bit of a higher false positive, but nevertheless, a very strong assay here as well. I think authors rightly said that that the specificity was good, about 90%, and that that this assay really could get turned around fairly quickly and give performance characteristics that were encouraging.
The next papers are Lapalusa et al., long-term efficacy of pembrolizumab and the clinical utility of ctDNA in locally advanced dMMR MSI-high solid tumors, Nature Communications 2025, and Cohn et al., real-world monitoring of ctDNA reliably predicts cancer recurrence and treatment efficacy in patients with resected stage 1 to 3 colon cancer, Annals of Surgery 2025.
This is a study that we did looking at using immunotherapy and MSI-high primary tumors. So this was previously reported out that, of course, pembrolizumab, like many PD-1s, worked really well in the neoadjuvant setting. But also this idea to say, can you look at an early time point and see whether or not a patient may be deriving benefit from this. And so this was report where, again, small numbers, so the caveat there, but we did kind of collect ctDNA and looked with this tumor-informed assay and able to show a difference in both the recurrence and a trend in overall survival, suggesting that an early time point on ctDNA may be able to really really segregate those patients that are deriving the most benefit from the neoadjuvant therapy.
What about ctDNA MRD analysis after 2 years of IO, you know, at the point where maybe people are trying to decide whether to stop or not? Can you see a positivity there?
So you can. It's uncommon, but it is meaningful, right? So the idea to say at 2 years, when we normally would say, well, let's stop, and that's what the studies have done. The majority of patients remain ctDNA negative at that point. But what we can see is that that there are some patients that are still positive, fairly rare at that later 2 year point.
Any rough estimate of how often you see relapse after people are in CR for 2 years?
It is single digits percentages. So the vast majority of patients. And it's a big question that comes up, especially because many of these patients are not in a radiographic CR, but still have nodules that are evident in the peritoneum or elsewhere. And these are really scar tissues. So it's so this is where ctDNA can help, because radiographically you'll say, I still see something on the scans. And this can help reassure that, nope, it's okay to stop at 2 years because there's no evidence of disease remaining.
That's interesting. So some of these partial responses are actually complete responses.
Are cures, right. Yeah, there was a series of about 15 patients that went to surgery for those nodules before we really understood them. And 14 out of the 15, even though we had centimeter or two lesions still remaining, those were scar tissue that was just fibroblasts and no residual tumor cells.
So interesting. So this is a final paper I was curious about. We see so many real-world studies nowadays in oncology. A lot of times they're very informative. I'm curious what your thoughts are about this paper.
Yeah, so this is a cohort that was done that looked at over 6,000 time points, about 800 patients, and looking at some of these same features. Now, the difference here is this is real-world. So these were, providers that were ordering ctDNA, and they're not part of a prospective study. And so really gave us a sense of how often this was being utilized and the impact of it. And what we saw was that, indeed, in the real world, very similar to these prospective observational studies, that you get huge differences in them. Again, not randomized, but those that received adjuvant that were positive had better outcomes than those who didn't post-surgery, and that those that were MRD negative, really no discernible difference in outcomes with adjuvant therapy. So reassuring that the real world is aligning with what a lot of these cohorts previously have shown.
I'm curious, in your clinical practice outside of clinical trial, and I know how often you have patients who aren't going into clinical trials because you have so many going on there, but if for some reason the patient's not eligible, or just more of a theoretical thought, from your point of view, do you believe that the current data supports, or do you use yourself cell-free DNA in deciding about stage 2 or stage 3 disease?
Right. For stage 2, absolutely. We're utilizing it, following the guidelines saying, positive, it's a high risk factor, can be used for deciding adjuvant therapy. Stage 3, again, we try to enroll on studies, but really it's part of that conversation. And we talk about whether patients want that or not, the benefits of that therapy. But we incorporate a lot of surveillance, a lot of testing after the fact, and been thinking about how we can use that to titrate the intensity of our CT scans, obviously try to get them on interventional studies if they're positive. But even if patients can't enroll on studies, we know that diet exercise, you know, maybe aspirin, celecoxib, perhaps. There's a number of things that we can potentially do. And I will say anecdotally, nothing gets patients on a treadmill more sustained and more reliably than being ctDNA positive and having that conversation to say, all right, there's something there. Here's our window. You know, the Canadian exercise study showed real benefits. Like, let's get going and see if exercise can help clear it.